glad of something concrete to do. "Barclay's going to go back onto Jimmy and Flick," said Strike. "And I..." He left a small pause, deliberately dramatic, and Robin laughed. "And you're..." "I'm going to interview Billy Knight and Della Wynne."
"What?" said Robin, amazed. "How are you going to get into the hospital? And she'll never agree."
"Well, that's where you're wrong," said Strike. "Izzy dug Della's number out of Chisel's records for me. I just rang her. I admit I was expecting her to tell me to piss off."
"In slightly more elevated language, if I know Della," Robin suggested.
"And she sounded initially as though she wanted to," admitted Strike. "But Amir's disappeared."
"What?" said Robin sharply.
"Calm down. Disappeared is Della's word. In reality, he resigned the day before yesterday and vacated his house, which hardly makes him a missing person. He's not picking up the phone to her. She's blaming me because, her words again, I did a fine job on him when I went round to question him. She says he's very fragile, and it'll be my fault if he ends up doing himself a mischief. So, you've offered to find him in exchange for her answering questions?"
"Write him one," said Strike. "She jumped at the offer. Says I'll be able to reassure him that he's not in trouble, and that nothing unsavoury I might have heard about him will go any further."
"I hope he's all right," said Robin, concerned. "He really didn't like me, but that just proves he's smarter than any of the rest of them. When are you meeting Della?"
7 o'clock this evening at her house in Bermondsey. And tomorrow afternoon, if all goes to plan, I'm going to be talking to Billy. I checked with Barclay, and Jimmy's got no plans to visit then, so I call the hospital. I'm waiting for Billy's psychiatrist to call me back now and confirm."
"You think they'll let you question him?"
"Supervised, yeah, I think they will. They're interested in seeing how lucid he is if he gets to talk to me. He's back on his meds and greatly improved, but he's still telling the story of the strangled kid. If the psychiatric team's in agreement, I'm going to be visiting the locked ward tomorrow."
"Well, great. It's good to have things to be getting on with. God knows we could use a breakthrough. Even if it is about the death we're not being paid to investigate," she sighed.
"There might not be a death at the bottom of Billy's story at all," said Strike. "But it's going to bug me forever unless we find out. I'll let you know how I get on with Della."
Robin wished him luck, bade him goodbye and ended the call, though she remained lying on her half-made bed. After a few seconds she said aloud, "Blanc de Blancs." Once again she had the sense of a buried memory shifting, issuing a gust of low mood. Where on earth had she seen that phrase, while feeling miserable? "Blanc de Blancs," she repeated, getting off the bed. "Blanc de...
Ow!"
She had put her bare foot down on something small and very sharp. Bending down, she picked up a backless diamond stud earring. At first, she merely stared at it, her pulse unaltered. The earring wasn't hers. She owned no diamond studs. She wondered why she hadn't trodden on it when she climbed into bed with a sleeping Matthew in the early hours of the morning. Perhaps her barefoot had missed it, or more probably, the earring had been in the bed and displaced only when Robin pulled off the undersheet. Of course, there were many diamond stud earrings in the world. The fact remained that the pair to which Robin's attention had most recently been drawn had been Sarah Shadlock's. Sarah had been wearing them the last time Robin and Matthew had gone to dinner, the night that Tom had attacked Matthew with sudden and apparently unwarranted ferocity. For what felt like a very long time, but was in reality little over a minute, Robin sat contemplating the diamond in her hand. Then she laid the earring carefully on her bedside cabinet, picked up her mobile, entered settings, removed her caller ID, then phoned Tom's mobile. He answered within a couple of rings, sounding grumpy. In the background, a presenter was wondering aloud what the forthcoming Olympic closing ceremony would be like.
"Yeah, hello?"
Robin hung up. Tom wasn't playing five-a-side football. She continued to sit motionless, her phone in her hand, on the heavy matrimonial bed that had been so difficult to move up the narrow stairs of this lovely rented house, while her mind moved back over the clear signs that she, the detective, had willfully ignored.
"I'm so stupid,"
Robin said quietly to the empty sunlit room.
"So bloody stupid."
Chapter 54. Your gentle and upright disposition, your polished mind, your unimpeachable honour, are known to and appreciated by everyone. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmer's Holm. Though the early evening was still bright, Della's front garden lay in shadow, which gave it a placid, melancholy air, in contrast to the busy, dusty road that ran beyond the gates. As Strike rang the doorbell, he noted two large dog turds on the otherwise immaculate front lawn, and he wondered who was helping Della with such mundane tasks now that her marriage was over. The door opened, revealing the Minister for Sport in her impenetrable black glasses. She was wearing what Strike's elderly aunt back in Cornwall would have called a housecoat, a knee-length purple fleece robe that buttoned to the high neck, giving her a vaguely ecclesiastic air. The guide dog stood behind her, looking up at Strike with dark, mournful eyes.
"Hi, it's Cormoran Strike," said the detective, without moving.
Given that she could neither recognize him by sight nor examine any of the identification he carried, the only way she could know whom she was admitting to her house was by the sound of his voice.
"We spoke on the phone earlier, and you asked me to come and see you."
"Yes,"
she said, unsmiling. "Come in, then." She stepped back to let him pass, one hand on the Labrador's collar. Strike entered, wiping his feet on the doormat. A swell of music, loud strings and woodwind instruments, cut through by the pounding of a kettle drum, issued from what Strike assumed was the sitting room. Strike, who had been raised by a mother who listened mainly to metal bands, knew very little about classical music. But there was a looming, ominous quality about this music that he didn't particularly care for. The house was dark, because the lights hadn't been turned on, and otherwise nondescript, with a dark brown pattern carpet that, while practical, was rather ugly.
"I've made coffee," said Della. "I'll need you to carry the tray into the sitting room for me, if you wouldn't mind." "No problem," said Strike.
He followed the Labrador, which padded along at Della's heels, its tail wagging vaguely. The symphony grew louder as they passed the sitting room, the doorframe of which Della touched lightly as she passed, feeling for familiar markers to orientate herself.
"Is that Beethoven?" asked Strike, for something to say.
"Brahms, Symphony No. 1, C minor."
The edges of every surface in the kitchen were rounded. The knobs on the oven, Strike noticed, had raised numbers stuck to them. On a cork notice board was a list of phone numbers headed "In Case of Emergency," that he imagined were for the use of a cleaner or home help. While Della crossed to the worktop opposite, Strike extracted his mobile from his coat pocket and took a picture of Geraint Wynne's number. Della's outstretched hand reached the rim of the deep ceramic sink, and she moved sideways, where a tray sat already laden with a mug and a cafetiere of freshly brewed coffee. Two bottles of wine stood beside it. Della felt for both of these, turned and held them out to Strike, still unsmiling.
"Which is which?" she asked.
"Chateau Neuf de Pape 2010 in your left hand," said Strike, "and Chateau Moussard 2006 in your right."
"I'll have a glass of Chateau Neuf de Pape, if he wouldn't mind opening the bottle and pouring it for me.
I assumed that you wouldn't want to drink, but if you do, help yourself."
"Thanks," said Strike, picking up the corkscrew she had laid beside the tray. "Coffee will be fine."
She set off silently for the sitting room, leaving him to follow with the tray. As he entered the room, he caught the heavy scent of roses and was fleetingly reminded of Robin. While Della grazed furniture with her fingertips, feeling her way towards an armchair with wide wooden arms, Strike saw four large bunches of flowers positioned in vases around the room and punctuating the overall drabness with their vivid colours, red, yellow, and pink. Aligning herself by pressing the backs of her legs against the chair, Della sat down neatly, then turned her face toward Strike as he set the tray on the table. "Would you put my glass here, on my right chair arm?" she asked, patting it. And he did so, while the pale Labrador, which had flopped down beside Della's chair, watched him out of kind, sleepy eyes. The strings of the violins in the symphony swooped and fell as Strike sat down. From the fawn carpet to the furniture, all of which might have been designed in the 70s, everything seemed to be in different shades of brown. Half of one wall was covered in built-in shelves holding what he thought must be at least 1,000 CDs. On a table to the rear of the room was a stack of Braille manuscripts. A large framed photograph of a teenage girl sat on the mantelpiece. It occurred to Strike that her mother could not even enjoy the bittersweet solace of looking at Rhiannon Wynne every day, and he found himself filled with inconvenient compassion.
"Nice flowers," he commented.
"Yes, it was my birthday a few days ago," said Della.
"Ah, many happy returns.
Are you from the West Country?"
"Partly Cornwall. I can hear it in your vowels," said Della.
She waited while he dealt with a cafetiere and poured himself coffee. When the sounds of clinking and pouring had ceased, she said,
"As I said on the phone, I'm very worried about Amir. He'll still be in London, I'm sure, because it's all he's ever known. Not with his family," she added, and Strike thought he heard a trace of contempt. "I'm extremely concerned about him."
She felt carefully for the wine glass next to her and took a sip.
"When you've reassured him that he isn't in any kind of trouble, and that anything Chisel told you about him will go no further, you must tell him to contact me, urgently."
The violins continued to screech and whine in what, to the untutored Strike, was a dissonant expression of foreboding. The guide dog scratched herself, her paw thudding off the carpet. Strike took out his notebook.
"Have you got the names or contact details of any friends Malik might have gone to?"
"No," said Della. "I don't think he has many friends. Latterly he mentioned someone from university, but I don't remember a name. I doubt it was anyone particularly close."
The thought of this distant friend seemed to make her uneasy.
"He studied at the LSE, so that's an area of London he knows well."
"He's on good terms with one of his sisters, isn't he?"
"Oh, no," said Della at once. "No, no, they all disowned him. No, he's got nobody, really, other than me, which is what makes this situation so dangerous."
"The sister posted a picture on Facebook of the two of them fairly recently. It was in that pizza joint opposite your house."
Della's expression betrayed not merely surprise, but displeasure.
"Amir told me you'd been snooping online. Which sister was it?"
"I'd have to
But I doubt he'd be staying with her," said Della, talking over him. "Not with the way the family as a whole has treated him.
He might have contacted her, I suppose.
You might see what she knows."
"I will," said Strike. "Any other ideas about where he might go?"
"He really doesn't have anyone else," she said. "That's what worries me. He's vulnerable. It's essential I find him."
"Well, I'll certainly do my best," Strike promised her. "Now, you said on the phone that you'd answer a few questions."
Her expression became slightly more forbidding.
"I doubt I can tell you anything of interest, but go on." "Can we start with Jasper Chisel and you and your husband's relationship with him?"
By her expression, she managed to convey that she found the question both impertinent and slightly ludicrous. With a cold smile and a raised eyebrow, she responded,
"Well, Jasper and I had a professional relationship, obviously."
"And how was that?" asked Strike,
adding sugar to his coffee, stirring it, and taking a sip.
"Given," said Della, "that Jasper hired you to try and discover disreputable information about us, I think you already know the answer to that question." You maintain that your husband wasn't blackmailing Chisel, then, do you? Of course I do.
Strike knew that pushing on this particular point, when Della's super-injunction had already shown what lengths she would go to in her own defence, would only alienate her. A temporary retreat seemed indicated.
What about the rest of the Chisels? Did you ever run across any of them?
Some, she said, a little warily.
And how did you find them?
I barely know them. Geraint says Izzy was hard-working.
Chisel's late son was on the junior British fencing team with your daughter, I think.
The muscles of her face seemed to contract. He was reminded of an anemone shutting in on itself when it senses a predator.
Yes, she said.
Did you like Freddy?
I don't think I ever spoke to him. Geraint was the one who ferried Rhiannon around to her tournaments. He knew the team. The shadow stems of the roses closest to the window stretched like bars across the carpet. The Brahms symphony crashed stormily on in the background. Della's opaque lenses contributed to a feeling of inscrutable menace, and Strike, though wholly unintimidated, was put in mind of the blind oracles and seers that peopled ancient myths, and the particular supernatural aura attributed by the able-bodied to this one particular disability.
What was it that made Jasper Chisel so eager to find out things to your disadvantage, would you say?
He didn't like me, said Della simply. We disagreed frequently. He came from a background that finds anything that deviates from its own conventions and norms to be suspect, unnatural, even dangerous. He was a rich, white, conservative male, Mr. Strike, and he felt the corridors of power were best populated exclusively by rich, white, conservative males. He sought in everything to restore a status quo he remembered in his youth. In pursuit of that objective, he was frequently unprincipled and certainly hypocritical.
In what way?
Ask his wife.
You know Kinvara, do you?
I wouldn't say I know her. I had an encounter with her a while ago that was certainly interesting in the light of Chisel's public proclamations about the sanctity of marriage. Strike had the impression that beneath the lofty language, and in spite of her genuine anxiety about Amir, Della was deriving pleasure from saying these things.
What happened? Strike asked.
Kinvara turned up unexpectedly late one afternoon at the ministry, but Jasper had already left for Oxfordshire. I think it was her aim to surprise him.
When was this?
I should say a year ago at least,
shortly before Parliament went into recess, I think. She was in a state of great distress. I heard a commotion outside and went to find out what was going on. I could tell by the silence of the outer office that they were all agog. She was very emotional, demanding to see her husband. Initially, I thought she must have had dreadful news and perhaps needed Jasper as a source of comfort and support. I took her into my office. Once it was just the two of us, she broke down completely. She was barely coherent, but from the little I could understand, said Della, she'd just found out there was another woman.
Did she say who?
I don't think so. She may have done, but she was... Well, it was quite disturbing, said Della austerely, more as though she had suffered a bereavement than the end of a marriage. I was just part of his game. He never loved me, and so forth.
What game did you take her to mean? Asked Strike.
The political game, I suppose. She spoke of being humiliated, of being told in so many words that she had served her purpose. Jasper Chisel was a very ambitious man, you know. He'd lost his career once over infidelity. I imagine he cast around quite clinically for the kind of new wife who'd burnish his image. No more Italian fly-by-nights, now he was trying to get back into the cabinet. He probably thought Kinvara would go down very well with the county conservatives. Well-bred, horsey. I heard later that Jasper had bundled her off into some kind of psychiatric clinic not long afterwards. That's how families like the Chisels deal with excessive emotion, I suppose. said Della, taking another sip of wine. Yet she stayed with him. Of course people do stay, even when they're treated abominably. He talked about her within my hearing as though she was a deficient, needy child. I remember him saying Kinvara's mother would be babysitting her for her birthday, because he had to be in Parliament for a vote. He could have paired his vote, of course, found a Labour MP and struck a deal. Simply couldn't be bothered. Women like Kinvara Chisel, whose entire self-worth is predicated on the status and success of marriage, are naturally shattered when everything goes wrong. I think all those horses of hers were an outlet, a substitute, and... Oh, yes, said Della. I've just remembered. The very last thing she said to me that day was that in addition to everything else, she now had to go home and put down a beloved mare. Della felt for the broad, soft head of Gwyn, who was lying beside her chair. I felt very sorry for her there. Animals have been an enormous consolation to me in my life. One can hardly overstate the comfort they give sometimes. The hand that caressed the dog still sported a wedding ring, Strike noticed, along with a heavy amethyst ring that matched her housecoat. Somebody, he supposed Geraint, must have told her that it was the same colour, and again he felt an unwelcome pang of pity. "Did Kinvara tell you how or when she'd found out that her husband had been unfaithful?" "No, no. She simply gave way to an almost incoherent outpouring of rage and grief, like a small child. Kept saying, 'I loved him and he never loved me, it was all a lie.' I've never heard such a raw explosion of grief, even at a funeral or a deathbed. I never spoke to her again except for hello. She acted as though she had no memory of what had passed between us." Della took another sip of wine. "Can we return to Malik?" Strike asked. "Yes, of course," she said at once. "The morning that Jasper Chisel died, the 13th, you were here, at home." There was a lengthy silence. "Why are you asking me that?" Della said, in a changed tone. "Because I'd like to corroborate a story I've heard," said Strike. "You mean that Amir was here with me that morning?" "Exactly." "Well, that's quite true. I slipped downstairs and sprained my wrist. I called Amir and he came over. He wanted me to go to casualty, but there was no need. I could still move all my fingers. I simply needed some help managing breakfast and so on." "You called Malik?"
"What?"
she said.
It was the age-old transparent what of the person who is afraid they've made a mistake. Strike guessed that some very rapid thinking was going on behind the dark glasses. "You called Amir."
"Why? What does he say happened?"
"He says your husband went in person to fetch him from his house."
"Oh," said Della, and then, "Of course, yes, I forgot."
"Did you?" asked Strike gently. "Or are you backing up their story?"
"I forgot," Della repeated firmly. "When I say I called him, I wasn't talking about the telephone. I meant that I called on him, via Geraint."
"But if Geraint was here when you slipped, couldn't he have helped you with your breakfast?"
"I think Geraint wanted Amir to help persuade me to go to casualty."
"Right. So it was Geraint's idea to go to Amir rather than yours."
"I can't remember now," she said. But then, contradicting herself, "I'd fallen rather heavily. Geraint has a bad back. Naturally, he wanted help, and I thought of Amir. And then the pair of them nagged me to go to A&E, but there was no need. It was a simple sprain."
The light was now fading beyond the net curtains. Della's black lenses reflected the neon red of the dying sun above the rooftops.
"I'm extremely worried about Amir," she said again, in a strained voice.
"A couple more questions and I'm done," Strike replied.
"Jasper Chisel hinted in front of a room full of people that he knew something disreputable about Malik.
Can you tell me anything about that?"
"Yes, well, it was that conversation," said Della quietly, that first made Amir think about resigning. I could feel him pulling away from me after it happened.
And then you finished the job, didn't you? You went to his house to taunt him further.
There was no taunting, Mrs. Wynne.
Liwat, Mr. Strike. Did you never learn what that meant all the time you were in the Middle East?
Yes, I know what it means, said Strike, matter-of-factly. Sodomy. Chisels seemed to be threatening Amir with exposure.
Amir wouldn't suffer from exposure of the truth, I assure you, said Della fiercely. Not that it matters a jot. But he doesn't happen to be gay.
The Brahms Symphony continued on what to Strike was its gloomy and intermittently sinister course, horns and violins competing to jar the nerves.
"You want the truth," said Della loudly.
"Amir objected to being groped and harassed, felt up by a senior civil servant whose inappropriate touching of young men passing through his office is an open secret, even a joke. And when a comprehensive, educated Muslim boy loses his cool and smacks a senior civil servant, which of the two do you imagine finds themselves smeared and stigmatized? Which of them, do you think, becomes the subject of derogatory rumours and is forced out of a job?"
"I'm guessing," said Strike. "Not Sir Christopher Barraclough Burns."
"How did you know whom I was talking about?" said Della sharply.
"Still in the post, is he?" asked Strike,
ignoring the question.
"Of course he is. Everybody knows about his harmless little ways, but nobody wants to go on the record. I've been trying to get something done about Barraclough Burns for years. When I heard Amir had left the diversity program in murky circumstances, I made it my business to find him. He was in a pitiable state when I first made contact with him, absolutely pitiable. Quite apart from the derailing of what should have been a stellar career, there was a malicious cousin who'd heard some gossip and spread the rumour that Amir had been fired for homosexual activity at work. Well, Amir's father isn't the sort of man to look kindly on a gay son. Amir had been resisting his parents' pressure to marry a girl they thought suitable. There was a terrible row and a complete breach. This brilliant young man lost everything, family, home and job, in the space of a couple of weeks.
So you stepped in.
Geraint and I had an empty property around the corner. Both our mothers used to live there. Neither Geraint nor I have siblings. It had become too difficult to manage our mother's care from London, so we brought them up from Wales and housed them together around the corner. Geraint's mother died 2 years ago. Mind this, so the house was empty. We didn't need the rent. It seemed only sensible to let Amir stay there.
And this was nothing but disinterested kindness, Strike said. You weren't thinking of how useful he might be to you when you gave him a job and a house.
What do you mean, useful? He's a very intelligent young man. Any office would be.
Your husband was pressuring Amir to get incriminating information on Jasper Chisel from the Foreign Office, Mrs. Wynne.
Photographs.
He was pressuring Amir to go to Sir Christopher for pictures.
Della reached out for her glass of wine, missed the stem by inches, and hit the glass with her knuckles. Strike lunged forwards to try and catch it, but too late. A whip-like trail of red wine described a parabola in the air and spattered the beige carpet, the glass falling with a thud beside it. Gwyn got up and approached the spill with mild interest, sniffing the spreading stain.
"How bad is it?" asked Della urgently, her fingers grasping the arms of her chair, her face inclined to the floor.
"Not good," said Strike.
"Salt, please, put salt on it, in the cupboard to the right of the cooker."
Turning on the light as he entered the kitchen, Strike's attention was caught for the first time by an odd something he had failed to spot on his previous entry into the room. An envelope stuck high up on a wall-mounted cabinet to the right, too high for Della to reach. Having grabbed the salt out of the cupboard, he made a detour to read the single word written on it. Geraint.
"To the right of the cooker,"
Della called a little desperately from the sitting room.
"Ah, the right!"
Strike shouted back, as he tugged down the envelope and slit it open. Inside was a receipt from Kennedy Bros, Joiners, for the replacement of a bathroom door. Strike licked his finger, dampened down the envelope flap, resealed it as best he could, and stuck it back where he had found it.
"Sorry," he told Della, re-entering the room. "It was right in front of me and I didn't notice."
He twisted the top of the cardboard tub and poured salt liberally over the purple stain. The Brahms symphony came to an end as he straightened up, dubious as to the likely success of the home remedy.
"Have you done it?"
Della whispered into the silence.
"Yeah," said Strike, watching the wine rising into the white and turning it a dirty grey. "I think you're still gonna need a carpet cleaner, though."
"Oh, dear. The carpet was new this year."
She seemed deeply shaken, though whether this was entirely due to the spilled wine was, Strike thought, debatable. As he returned to the sofa and set down the salt beside the coffee, music started up again, this time a Hungarian air that was no more restful than the symphony, but weirdly manic.
"Would you like more wine?" he asked her.
Yes, I think I would," she said.
He poured her another and passed it directly into her hand. She drank a little, then said shakily,
"How could you know what you just told me, Mr. Strike?"
"I'd rather not answer that, but I assure you it's true."
Clutching her wine in both hands, Della said, "You have to find Amir for me. If he thought I sanctioned Geraint telling him to go to Barraclough Burns for favours, it's no wonder he—" Her self-control was visibly disintegrating. She tried to set the wine down on the arm of her chair and had to feel for it with the other hand before doing so successfully, all the while shaking her head in little jerks of disbelief.
"No wonder he what?" asked Strike quietly.
"Accused me of smothering, controlling. Well, of course, this explains everything. We were so close, you wouldn't understand. It's hard to explain. But it was remarkable how soon we became, well, like family. Sometimes, you know, there's an instant affinity, a connection that years couldn't forge with other people. But these past few weeks it all changed. I could feel it, starting when Chisel made that jibe in front of everyone. Amir became distant. It was as though he no longer trusted me. I should have known. Oh, Lord, I should have known. You have to find him. You have to—"
Perhaps, Strike thought, the depth of her burning sense of need was sexual in origin. And perhaps on some subconscious level it had indeed been tinged with appreciation of Amir's youthful masculinity. However, as Rhiannon Wynne watched over them from her cheap gilt frame, wearing a smile that didn't reach her wide, anxious eyes, her teeth glinting with heavy braces, Strike thought it far more likely that Della was a woman possessed of that which Charlotte so conspicuously lacked, a burning, frustrated maternal drive tinged, in Della's case, with unassuageable regret.
"This as well," she whispered. "This as well. What hasn't he ruined?"
"You're talking about—"
"My husband," said Della numbly. "Who else? My charity, our charity. But you know that, of course. It was you who told Chisel about the missing 25,000, wasn't it?
And the lies, the stupid lies Geraint's been telling people.
David Beckham, Mo Farah, all those impossible promises.
My partner found out."
"Nobody will believe me," said Della distractedly. "But I didn't know. I had no idea. I've missed the last 4 board meetings, preparations for the Paralympics. Geraint only told me the truth after Chisel threatened him with the press. Even then he claimed it was the accountant's fault, but he swore to me the other things weren't true. Swore it on his mother's grave."
She twisted the wedding ring on her finger, apparently distracted. I suppose your wretched partner tracked down Elspeth Lacey Curtis as well.
Afraid so, lied Strike, judging that a gamble was indicated. Did Geraint deny that, too?
If he'd said anything to make the girls uncomfortable, he felt awful. But he swore there was nothing else to it, no touching, just a couple of risque jokes.
But in this climate, said Della furiously, a man ought to damn well think about what jokes he makes to a bunch of 15-year-old girls.
Strike leaned forward and grabbed Della's wine, which was in danger of being upended again.
What are you doing?
Moving your glass onto the table, said Strike.
Oh, said Della, thank you. Making a noticeable effort to control herself, she continued, Geraint was representing me at that event, and it will go the way it always goes in the press when it all comes out. It will have been my fault, all of it. Because men's crimes are always ours in the final analysis, aren't they, Mr. Strike? Ultimate responsibility always lies with the woman, who should have stopped it, who should have acted, who must have known. Your failings are really our failings, aren't they? Because the proper role of the woman is carer, and there's nothing lower in this whole world than a bad mother.
Breathing hard, she pressed her trembling fingers to her temples. Beyond the net curtains, night, deep blue, was inching like a veil over the glaring red of sunset, and as the room grew darker, Rhiannon Wynne's features faded gradually into the twilight. Soon, all that would be visible was her smile, punctuated by the ugly braces.
"Give me back my wine, please."
Strike did so. Della drank most of it down at once, and continued to clasp the glass as she said bitterly, "There are plenty of people ready to think all kinds of odd things about a blind woman. Of course, when I was younger it was worse. There was often a prurient interest in one's private life. It was the first place some men's minds went. Perhaps you've experienced it too, have you, with your one leg?"
Strike found that he didn't resent the blunt mention of his disability from Della.
"Yeah, I've had a bit of that," he admitted. "Bloke I was at school with, hadn't seen him in years. It was my first time back in Cornwall since I got blown up. 5 points in, he asked me at what point I warned women my leg was going to come off with my trousers. He thought he was being funny."
Della smiled thinly. "Never occurs to some people that it is we who should be making the jokes, does it? But it will be different for you as a man. Most people seem to think it in the natural order of things that the able-bodied woman should look after the disabled man. Geraint had to deal with that for years, people assuming there was something peculiar about him because he chose a disabled wife. I think I may have tried to compensate for that. I wanted him to have a role, status. But it would have been better for both of us in retrospect if he had done something unconnected to me."
Strike thought she was a little drunk. Perhaps she hadn't eaten. He felt an inappropriate desire to check her fridge. Sitting here with this impressive and vulnerable woman, it was easy to understand how Amir had become so entangled with her, both professionally and privately, without ever intending to become so. "People assume I married Geraint because there was nobody else who wanted me. But they are quite wrong," said Della, sitting up straighter in her chair. "There was a boy I was at school with who was smitten with me, who proposed when I was 19. I had a choice and I chose Geraint, not as a carer, or because, as journalists have sometimes implied, my limitless ambition made a husband necessary, but because I loved him." Strike remembered the day he had followed Della's husband to the stairwell in King's Cross, and the tawdry things that Robin had told him about Geraint's behaviour at work. Yet nothing that Della had just said struck him as incredible. Life had taught him that a great and powerful love could be felt for the most apparently unworthy people, a circumstance that ought, after all, to give everybody consolation.
"Are you married, Mr. Strike?"
No, he said. I think marriage is nearly always an unfathomable entity, even to the people inside it. It took this, all of this mess, to make me realize I can't go on. I don't really know when I stopped loving him. But at some point after Rhiannon died, it slipped. Her voice broke. Slipped away from us. She swallowed. Please will you pour me another glass of wine? He did so. The room was very dark now. The music had changed again to a melancholy violin concerto, which at last, in Strike's opinion, was appropriate to the conversation. Della had not wanted to talk to him, but now seemed reluctant to let the conversation end. "Why did your husband hate Jasper Chisel so much?" Strike asked quietly. "Because of Chisel's political clashes with you, or—"
"No, no," said Della Wynne wearily. "Because Geraint has to blame somebody other than himself for the misfortunes that befall him."
Strike waited, but she merely drank more wine and said nothing.
"What exactly?"
"Never mind," she said loudly. "Never mind, it doesn't matter."
But a moment later, after another large gulp of wine, she said,
"Rhiannon didn't really want to do fencing. Like most little girls, what she wanted was a pony. But we, Geraint and I, we didn't come from pony-owning backgrounds. We didn't have the first idea what one does with horses. As I think back, I suppose there were ways around that. But we were both terribly busy, and felt it would be impractical. So she took up fencing instead, and very good she was at it, too.
Have I answered enough of your questions, Mr. Strike?" she asked, a little thickly. "Will you find Amir?"
"I'll try," Strike promised her. "Could you give me his number, and yours, so I can keep you updated?"
She had both numbers off by heart, and he copied them down before closing his notebook and getting back to his feet.
"You've been very helpful, Mrs. Wynne. Thank you."
"That sounds worrying," she said, with a faint crease between the eyebrows. "I'm not sure I meant to be."
"Will you be?"
"Perfectly," said Della, enunciating over clearly. "You'll call me when you find Amir, won't you?"
"If you don't hear from me before then, I'll update you in a week's time," Strike promised.
Is anyone coming in tonight, or—"
"I see you aren't quite as hardened as your reputation would suggest," said Della. "Don't worry about me. My neighbour will be in to walk Gwyn for me shortly. She checks the gas dials and so forth. In that case, don't get up. Good night."
The near white dog raised her head as he walked towards the door, sniffing the air. He left Della sitting in the darkness a little drunk, with nothing else for company but the picture of the dead daughter she had never seen. Closing the front door, Strike couldn't remember the last time he had felt such a strange mixture of admiration, sympathy, and suspicion. Chapter 55. Let us at least fight with honourable weapons, since it seems we must fight. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Matthew, who had supposedly been out just for the morning, still hadn't come home. He had sent two texts since, one at 3 in the afternoon. "Tom got work troubles, wants to talk, gone to pub with him, I'm on cokes, back as soon as I can." And then at 7 o'clock, "Really sorry, he's pissed, I can't leave him. Going to find him a taxi, then come back. Hope you've eaten, love you, kiss." Still with her caller ID switched off, Robin had again phoned Tom's mobile. He had answered immediately. There was no background babble of a pub. "Yes," said Tom testily, and apparently sober. "Who is this?" Robin hung up. Two bags were packed and waiting in the hall. She had already phoned Vanessa and asked whether she could stay on her sofa for a couple of nights before she got a new place to live. She found it strange that Vanessa didn't sound more surprised, but at the same time was glad not to have to fend off pity. Waiting in the sitting room, watching nightfall outside the window, Robin wondered whether she would ever have been suspicious if she had not found the earring. Lately she had become simply grateful for time without Matthew, when she could relax, not having to hide anything, whether the work she was doing on the chisel case or the panic attacks that must be conducted quietly, without fuss, on the bathroom floor. Sitting in the stylish armchair belonging to their absent landlord, Robin felt as though she were inhabiting a memory. How often were you aware, while it happened, that you were living an hour that would change the course of your life forever? She would remember this room for a long time, and she gazed around it now, with the aim of fixing it in her mind, thereby trying to ignore the sadness, the shame and the pain that burned and twisted inside her. At just past 9 o'clock, she heard, with a wave of nausea, Matthew's key in the lock and the sound of the door opening.
"Sorry," he shouted, before he'd even closed the door. "He's a silly sod. I had a job persuading the taxi driver to take—"
Robin heard his small exclamation of surprise as he spotted the suitcases. Safe now to dial, she pressed the number she had ready on her phone. He walked into the sitting room, puzzled, in time to hear her booking a minicab. She hung up. They looked at each other. "What's with the cases?"
"I'm leaving."
There was a long silence. Matthew seemed not to understand.
"What do you mean?"
"I don't know how to say it any more clearly, Matt."
"Leaving me?"
"That's right."
"Why?"
"Because," said Robin, "you're sleeping with Sarah."
She watched Matthew struggling to find words that might save him, but the seconds slid by, and it was too late for real incredulity, for astonished innocence, for genuine incomprehension.
"What?"
he said at last, with a forced laugh.
"Please don't," she said. "There's no point. It's over."
He continued to stand in the doorway of the sitting room, and she thought he looked tired, even haggard.
"I was going to go and leave a note," said Robin, "but that felt too melodramatic. Anyway, there are practical things we need to talk about."
She thought she could see him thinking,
"How did I give it away? Who have you told?"
"Listen," he said urgently, dropping his sports bag beside him, full, no doubt, of clean-pressed kit. "I know things haven't been good between us, you and me, but it's you I want, Robin. Don't throw us away, please." He walked forwards, dropped into a crouch beside her chair, and tried to take her hand. She pulled it away, genuinely astonished.
"You're sleeping with Sarah," she repeated.
He got up, crossed to the sofa and sat down, dropped his face into his hands and said weakly,
"I'm sorry, I'm sorry. It's been so shit between you and me that you had to sleep with your friend's fiancé."
He looked up at that, in sudden panic.
"Have you spoken to Tom? Does he know?"
Suddenly unable to bear his proximity, she walked away towards the window, full of a contempt she had never felt before.
"Even now, worried about your promotion prospects, Matt."
"No, fuck, you don't understand," he said. "It's over between me and Sarah."
"Oh, really?"
"Yes," he said. "Yes, fuck, this is so fucking ironic. We talked all day, we agreed it couldn't go on, not after you and Tom. We've just ended it an hour ago."
"Wow," said Robin with a little laugh, feeling disembodied. "Isn't that ironic?"
Her mobile rang. Dreamlike, she answered it.
"Robin," said Strike. "Update. I've just seen Della win."
"How did it go?"
she asked, trying to sound steady and bright, determined not to cut the call short. Her working life was now her entire life, and Matthew would no longer impinge upon it. Turning her back on her fuming husband, she looked out onto the dark cobbled street.
Very interesting on two counts, said Strike. Firstly, she slipped up. I don't think Geraint was with Amir the morning Chisel died.
That is interesting, said Robin, forcing herself to concentrate, aware of Matthew watching her.
I've got a number for him, and I tried it, but he's not picking up. I thought I'd see if he's still at the B&B down the road as I'm in the vicinity, but the owner says he's moved on.
Shame. What was the other interesting thing? Asked Robin.
Is that Strike? Asked Matthew loudly from behind her.
She ignored him.
What was that? Asked Strike.
Nothing, said Robin. Go on.
Well, the second interesting thing is that Della met Kinvara last year, who was hysterical because she thought Chisel...
Robin's mobile was pulled roughly out of her hand. She wheeled around. Matthew ended the call with a stab of his finger.
How dare you! Shouted Robin, holding out her hand. Give that back! We're trying to save our fucking marriage, and you're taking calls from him?
I'm not trying to save this marriage.
Give me back my phone!
He hesitated, then thrust it back at her, only to look outraged when she coolly phoned Strike back again.
Sorry about that, Cormoran.
We got cut off, she said, with Matthew's wild eyes on her.
Everything all right there, Robin?
It's fine. What were you saying about Chisel?
That he was having an affair.
An affair, said Robin, her eyes on Matthew's. Who with?
Christ knows. Have you had any luck getting hold of Raphael? We know he's not that bothered about protecting his father's memory. He might tell us.
I left a message for him and for Tegan. Neither of them have called back.
Okay, well, keep me posted. This all sheds an interesting light on the hammer round the head, though, doesn't it?
Certainly does, said Robin.
That's me at the tube. Sure you're all right?
Yes, of course, said Robin, with what she hoped sounded like workaday impatience. Speak soon. She hung up.
Speak soon.
Matthew imitated her in the high-pitched, wispy voice he always used when impersonating women.
Speak later, Cormoran. I'm running out of my marriage so I can be at your beck and call forever, Cormoran. I don't mind working for minimum wage, Cormoran. Not if I can be your skivvy.
Fuck off, Matt, said Robin calmly. Fuck off back to Sarah. The earring she left in our bed is upstairs on my bedside table, by the way.
Robin, he said, suddenly earnest, we can get through this. If we love each other, we can.
Well, the problem with that, Matt, said Robin, is that I don't love you any more. She had always thought the idea of eyes darkening was literary license, but she saw his light eyes turn black as his pupils dilated in shock.
You bitch, he said quietly.
She felt a cowardly impulse to lie, to back away from the absolute statement, to protect herself, but something stronger in her held on. The need to tell the unvarnished truth, when she had been lying to him and herself for so long. No, she said, I don't. We should have split up on the honeymoon. I stayed because you were ill. I felt sorry for you. No, she corrected herself. Determined to do the thing properly. Actually, we should never have gone on the honeymoon. I ought to have walked out of the wedding once I knew you deleted those calls from Strike. She wanted to check her watch to see when her cab would arrive, but she was scared to take her eyes off her husband. There was something in his expression that recalled a snake peering out from under a rock. How do you think your life looks to other people? He asked quietly.
What do you mean?
You bailed out on uni, now you're bailing out on us. You even bailed out on your therapist, you're a fucking flake. The only thing you haven't run out on is this stupid job that's half killed you, and you got sacked from that. He only took you back because he wants to get into your pants, and he probably can't get anyone else so cheap.
She felt as though he had punched her. Winded, her voice sounded weak.
Thanks, Matt, she said,
moving towards the door.
Thanks for making this so easy.
But he moved quickly to block her exit.
It was a temping job,
He paid you attention, so you kidded yourself that was the career for you, even though it's the last fucking thing you should have been doing with your history.
She was fighting tears now, but determined not to succumb.
I wanted to do police work for years and years.
No, you fucking didn't, jeered Matthew. When did you ever? I had a life before you.
Robin shouted.
I had a home life where I said things you never heard. I never told you, Matthew, because I knew you'd laugh like my dickhead brothers. I did psychology, hoping it would take me to some kind of forensic. You never said this. You're trying to justify. I didn't tell you because I knew you'd sneer. Bullshit. It isn't bullshit, she shouted. I'm telling you the truth. This is the whole truth, and you're proving my point. You don't believe me. You liked it when I dropped out of uni. The hell do you mean? There's no hurry to go back. You don't have to have a degree. Oh, so now I'm being fucking blamed for being sensitive. You liked it. You liked me being stuck at home. Why can't you admit it? Sarah Shadlock at uni and me underachieving back in Masham. It made up for me getting better A-levels than you. Getting into my first choice of... Oh, he laughed humorlessly. Oh, you got better fucking A-levels than me. Yeah, that keeps me up at night. If I hadn't been raped, we'd have split up years ago. Is this what you learned in therapy? To tell lies about the past, to justify all your bullshit? I learned to tell the truth, shouted Robin, driven to the point of brutality. And here's some more. I was falling out of love with you before the rape. You weren't interested in anything I was doing, my course, my new friends. All you wanted to know was whether any other blokes were making moves on me. But afterwards, you were so sweet, so kind. You seemed like the safest man in the world, the only one I could trust. That's why I stayed. We wouldn't be here now but for that rape. They both heard the car pull up outside. Robin tried to slide past him into the hall, but he moved to block her again.
No, you don't. You're not getting out of it that bloody easily. You stayed because it was safe? Fuck off. You love me.
I thought I did, said Robin. But not anymore. Get out of the way. I'm leaving.
She tried to sidestep him, but he moved to block her again.
No,
he said again. And now he moved forwards, jostling her back into the sitting room.
You're staying here. We're having this out.
The minicab driver rang the doorbell.
Coming!
Robin shouted. But Matthew snarled.
You're not running away this time. You're going to stay and sort out your mess.
No!
Shouted Robin, as though to a dog. She came to a halt, refusing to be back further into the room, even though he was so close she could feel his breath on her face. And she was suddenly reminded of Geraint Wynne, and was overwhelmed with revulsion.
Get away from me, now!
And like a dog, Matthew took a step backwards, responding not to the order, but to something in her voice. He was angry, but scared too.
Right, said Robin.
She knew she was on the edge of a panic attack, but she held on, and every second she did not dissolve was giving her strength, and she stood her ground.
I'm leaving. You try and stop me, I'll retaliate. I fought off far bigger, meaner men than you, Matthew. You haven't even got a bloody knife.
She saw his eyes turn blacker than ever, and suddenly she remembered how her brother, Martin, had punched Matthew in the face at the wedding. No matter what was coming, she vowed, in a kind of dark exhilaration. She'd do better than Martin. She'd break his damn nose if she had to.
Please, he said, his shoulders suddenly sagging. Robin, you're going to have to hurt me if you want to stop me leaving, but I warn you, I'll prosecute you for assault if you do. That won't go down too well at the office, will it?
She held his gaze for a few more seconds, then walked back towards him, her fists already curling, waiting for him to block or grab her. But he moved aside.
Robin, he said hoarsely, wait, seriously, wait. You said there were things we had to discuss. The lawyers can do it, she said,
reaching the front door and pulling it open. The cool night air touched her like a blessing. A stocky woman was sitting at the wheel of a Vauxhall Corsa. Seeing Robin's cases, she got out to help her hoist them into the boot. Matthew had followed and was now standing in the doorway. As Robin made to get into the car, he called to her, and her tears began to fall at last, but without looking at him, she slammed the door.